I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. A September Gallup poll found that a majority of Americans favor getting rid of the Electoral College and replacing it with a popular vote system, meaning the presidential candidate with the most votes wins. There have been five White House winners who lost the popular vote, including two this century in 2000 and in 2016. The framers fought over creating the Electoral College in 1787 at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, and there have been hundreds of attempts to repeal and replace it ever since. You probably know this, but it bears repeating. When you vote for president this fall, you're actually voting for nameless electors who will decide the winner on December 14th. So what were the framers thinking? How has the Electoral College distorted our politics? Why has the system survived so many attempts to dismantle it? And what would be a better way to pick a president? We have two guests who have joined us. Jesse Wegman is a member of the New York Times editorial board, author of a book titled Let the People Pick the President, A Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Jesse Wegman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Also with us is Kim Whaley. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Her book is What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Kim Whaley, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Happy to be here.
And to our listeners, and we've had a lot of questions, a lot of comments, a lot of just sort of confusion about the Electoral College. So there are several ways you can join our conversation. Send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me just put some of our discussion into a historical context. And Jesse Wegman, I'll start with you. What was the problem that the framers were trying to settle when they came up with the Electoral College?
Yes, well, you know, they were building a government and designing one for a self-governing republic, the scale of which hadn't been done before. So they were flying blind. They didn't know exactly how to choose the leader of such a country. And, you know, my title, Let the People Pick the President, it kind of, from modern ears, it sounds like a liberal's lament after the last 20 years. But in fact, I chose it in part because several of the most influential framers actually proposed this very method. You know, James Madison, James Wilson, Gouverneur Morris, they came out and they said the best way to choose the leader of a free self-governing republic is by a direct vote. They lost that argument. Why did they lose it? Well, there were several, you know, factors at the convention, all kind of cross-cutting each other. One of them was, of course, the role of slavery and the protection of the interests of the slaveholding states. That made it, as James Madison said very openly at the convention, it made it virtually impossible to go with a popular vote election because the South wouldn't be able to, you know, count all of its slaves. And then the other one is one that we heard about more when we were in school, which was, you know, the framers understood that they didn't have a country where people knew much about national political candidates. People just, there was no national media, there was no transportation network. So they were concerned that a lot of people just wouldn't know enough to make an informed decision. So they instituted this kind of intermediary body of people who might know more.
Let me quote a couple of the framers or the founders, John Jay, talking about the Electoral College will in general, and I'm quoting here, be composed of the most enlightened and respectable citizens. This is, of course, part of the Federalist Papers. Alexander Hamilton talking about electors being the most likely to possess the information and discernment that would allow them to choose the chief executive. Kim Whaley, it seems as if the founders didn't trust the American people to pick a president.
Well, prior to the Constitutional Convention, which was actually created or held in order to amend the Articles of Confederation, which was the quasi-constitution that was in place prior to that, it was more a system of a popular vote. And the framers in general were concerned that populism, sort of bad information, would run rampant through the populace. And then populism, this notion of sort of voting with the crowd on emotion, could lead people to make bad decisions, essentially to vote against their interests. And so the framers in a lot of ways, not just the Electoral College, created a representative system of government. So our elected officials, the Congress, represent us. We don't directly vote for any particular federal laws, for example. And so that certainly was the idea, and not just the Electoral College, but I think for a lot of reasons today, given frankly social media and the rise of the digital age, this notion that somehow the representative process protects us against populism is breaking down for a number of reasons.
Jesse Wegman, let me go back to you. And I think there have been something like 700 attempts to, if not reform, replace the Electoral College. Why has it survived these, 250 years?
Well, we're actually approaching 800 now. And the
okay,
reason
800.
That,
gotcha.
Yeah, yes. No, you're right. I think when I was drafting the book, it was in the 700s. And,
wow.
You know, it's just constantly going up. The reason that it survived, there's a couple reasons. One is just the inertia of our government system. And I think, you know, people don't push to change something that doesn't always look like it's breaking down. And I think part of the problem of the Electoral College is that when it doesn't split, you know, when the person who wins the popular vote also wins the Electoral College, people assume that it's working as it's designed. One of the major arguments of my book is that even when that happens, even when the Electoral College and the popular vote align, the system as it operates today actually serves to invalidate or make irrelevant the vast majority of American voters. But the other reason I think that it survives is that people basically parties, one party, the other party, or both, assume, rightly or wrongly, that it helps them in the short term, that it gives them a political benefit. Right now, Republicans clearly see that it benefits them, or they believe that it benefits them. The problem is that this is changing constantly, and there's no long-term systematic benefit to either side for having the Electoral College in place.
I'm not sure if we're having a little technical problem, but it seems like Jesse Wegman is his audio is going in and out. So hopefully we can fix that. Kim Whaley, let me turn to you. There have been five times when the winner of the Electoral College does not win the popular vote, twice in this century. Does that mean that we're kind of at loggerheads when it comes to the Electoral College?
I think, you know, people are upset about the Electoral College for those reasons. You know, the notion that the people, the will of the people, isn't actually carrying the presidency. But, you know, the Electoral College is in the Constitution itself. You know, 800 and counting attempts to change the Constitution. In that regard, I think the latest figure I saw from 2017 was almost 12,000 total attempts to actually amend the Constitution. It's really hard to change the Constitution by design. It takes two houses, both houses of Congress, two-thirds, to vote to change the Constitution, and then ratification by the legislatures of three-quarters of the states. That's vastly, vastly, vast numbers that are really difficult to corral together, as we can imagine now, given that the Congress can't even pass a follow-up COVID bill. So part of the problem is just the process for amending the Constitution. But as Jesse indicated, you know, there are one of the other, I think, real problems with the Electoral College is how the state legislatures direct their electors to actually cast their ballot. So we go into the voting booth, or by mail, or however we're doing it this election cycle, and we cast our vote. Essentially, we think we're casting it for president, but we're actually casting it for electors. And the states then, state legislatures, decide and tell the electors how they are supposed to vote for president. In all but two states, it's what we call winner takes all. So if 51% of the vote, popular vote, goes to Joe Biden, he gets 100% of the electors voting for him for president, which basically knocks out the 49% who voted for Trump or for a third party candidate. That's the problem. And the way to fix that without throwing out the Electoral College or attempting to amend the Constitution, which is so difficult, would, of course, be to elect people to the state legislatures that are going to come up with different ways of directing their electors to actually cast their ballots, perhaps ways that are more consistent with the popular vote. But then that gets into problems, for example, with gerrymandering, with, sure, you know, other ways that we put people in office that perhaps are not Democratic, and they stay entrenched in places that aren't in, you know, positions of power that aren't consistent with what the electorate wants.
You know, Jesse Wegman, I'd hate to have our listeners think, well, then maybe I shouldn't vote. I mean, the system sounds like it's so convoluted and doesn't really represent the people. Is there a danger when we talk about the Electoral College and how we actually do elect our presidents that it will depress the vote?
Absolutely. You can hear me now. Is that right?
Yeah, it's clearly a problem on my end.
Okay, great. No, good. No, I think Kim was really right to flag these state winner-take-all laws as the core of the problem with how the system operates today. And that's because when you have a system that gives all of a state's electors to one candidate and none to the other, it creates this hierarchy of states. You have two kinds of states. One of them is called a safe state. That's the state that most Americans live in. More than 80% of Americans live in safe states. And those are states where no amount of campaigning, no amount of cajoling by either candidate is going to make a difference, right? That state is definitely going for the Republican or definitely going for the Democrat. That doesn't mean there aren't millions of voters for the other candidate in that state. It just means there's a clear plurality or majority for one party or the other. The remaining states are what are called battleground states, and that is the essence of the problem. Now, in Pennsylvania, you guys are a battleground state, and this year you may be the most important battleground state. So as far as Pennsylvanians are concerned, this system is great. You know, everybody wants to know how Pennsylvanians are going to vote, and Pennsylvanians will vote at higher rates because they know their vote matters. Meanwhile, all over the country, millions and millions of Americans know that no matter whether they go to the polls or not, no one's going to care. And that really does, it depresses turnout, it depresses, you know, public participation in government, it depresses people's sense that the government is actually concerned for what, you know, their interests are. So I really think that gets at one of the central corrosions that the Electoral College causes under the winner-take-all law, which is it makes people feel, rightly, that their vote doesn't matter, and then they don't come out to vote.
Let me just pick up on that, and we're almost having a break here. Kim Whaley talking about Pennsylvania. Is that why fracking gets a lot of coverage? I mean, this is an issue of great concern to Pennsylvania with its 20 electoral college votes. But does that sort of distort what it is that gets discussed on the campaign trail?
Sure. I mean, think about the wildfires happening across the, you know, the West Coast. We're not seeing a lot of campaign focus on those. California, for example, which has been on fire in part because those votes are in a so-called safe state. And in addition to, as Jesse mentioned, this concern with slavery, sort of the North versus South divide, there was also a concern that the small states would be drowned out by the power of the larger states. So we see this in having two senators per state, regardless of population. So there are multiples, you know, of voting power, for example, in the Dakotas than there are in California in the Senate. But that is this notion of sort of using the Electoral College to even out the power of the states has also not worked, because as was indicated, I mean, Pennsylvania, Florida, these swing states get all the from the candidates. And that's not, I think, by design, in terms of why the Electoral College existed to begin with.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Kim Whaley. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Jesse Wigmuth is with us as well. He's a member of the New York Times editorial board, and his new book is Let the People Pick the President, A Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Again, you can join us, WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and talking with Kim Whaley and Jesse Wegman about the Electoral College, what the founders were thinking, how the college has distorted some of our electoral process, and what would be a better way to elect a president. Let me play a clip from a couple of decades ago. This is actually 1969. This is Senator Birch Bayh from Indiana. He's being interviewed discussing the Electoral College and reforming the Electoral College. He sponsored a Senate proposal for a constitutional amendment to replace the Electoral College with a popular vote, which President Nixon interestingly endorsed at the time. It fell short by about a dozen votes in the Senate to pass. But let's listen to Senator Bayh.
I think most people are aware that the present system is dangerous, it's outdated, it's archaic, it's one that needs to be revised and made responsive to the needs of today's electoral problems. In my judgment, the reform should meet a three-point criteria. I think the people should be personally involved. I think everybody's vote should count the same. And I think in the final analysis, the man who wins is the man who gets the most votes.
Of course, the woman to you, Jesse Wegman. Is that as close as we got to getting rid of the Electoral College?
It is. And it's an astonishing story. I tell it. I take a whole chapter in my book to tell it, because one of the things that amazed me as I began writing was that this had basically gone down the American memory hole, this effort that nearly got us to a popular vote in the late 1960s and early 1970s. As you say, Birch Bayh, the senator from Indiana, was the driving force behind the effort. And he actually, you know, he basically banged the drum on this for 4 years. And by the end of it, 80% of Americans in a Gallup poll were behind the Electoral College. So, I mean, supported the popular vote for president and said they wanted to get rid of the Electoral College. You know, and I think it's important to remember that Kim is absolutely right. Amending the Constitution is a very heavy lift. But Birch Bayh got us closer than anyone in American history. The House of Representatives in 1969 actually passed the amendment to abolish the Electoral College and in place of a popular vote, overwhelmingly 339-70. And in the Senate, it actually only failed by 5 votes. And the reason what was failing was not the actual vote. It was an attempt to end a filibuster. And it was a filibuster that was driven by Southern segregationists, people like Strom Thurmond. That was really the essence of the problem, right? It goes all the way back to the founding and slavery. These segregationists were the descendants of slaveholders themselves. And they knew that a popular vote was going to reduce their outsized power in choosing the president. So that it was killed by the segregationists in 1969, 1970 through a filibuster, and we haven't come that close again.
Kim Whaley, William from Medford has a question. Will abolishing the Electoral College require a constitutional convention? And as you mentioned earlier, it's not easy to change the Constitution. But if something like that were to pass, what are the various hurdles that would have to go through?
So there are 2 ways of amending the Constitution. One is a constitutional convention, as the caller indicates. The last time we had that was 1787. And that, as I indicated earlier, the plan was to amend the Articles of Confederation. And instead, they chucked that and started over. And that's why it's a precarious ask at this moment to have a constitutional convention. There is a movement across the country to do that. The last time I checked, I think there are 6 states that hadn't sort of signed on to doing that. On the progressive side, the goal in part is to do something about Citizens United basically holding that corporations have First Amendment rights to spend as much money as they want on the airwaves. And some believe the only way to basically get money out of politics and put it back in the hands of regular people is through a constitutional amendment. On the more conservative end would be to do something like abolish a tax code, which would unravel the federal government itself. The 27 amendments that have actually made it into the Constitution as law came through Congress. So that's how most of them happen, as I think Jesse just explained in the 1960s, very interesting anecdote. But that would require, again, both houses, 2/3, a supermajority of both houses to agree to it. And with this polarized Congress, we can't get basic legislation that most Americans want, even to a floor vote on the Senate. So it just doesn't seem feasible in 2010.
Jesse, let me put Larry's question to you. Why don't we just require electors to vote for the winner of the popular vote? You detail a chapter in your book called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, where electors would cast ballots for the winner of the national popular vote. Where does that stand today?
Well, it's actually the furthest along of any effort since the 1969-1970 effort that I just described. So just to restate the idea, this is an agreement among states to award their electors differently. As Kim said earlier in the program, the decision of how to award electors is not anywhere listed in the Constitution. It is only a state-based decision. States do it by winner-take-all in their state boundaries now. And what this agreement says is, instead of giving our electors just to the winner of our state, we are going to give our electors to the winner of the vote in all 50 states combined, plus D.C. And when that happens, and when states representing a majority of electoral votes join that agreement, you do the math and you realize, oh, the person who wins the most votes in the country will automatically win a majority of electoral votes and therefore become the president. 15 states have so far joined this agreement, plus DC, so that equals 196 electoral votes. That means they're 74 votes short of 270. The problem right now is that all the states that have joined it have Democratic leadership, what we would, you know, kind of glibly call blue states. There's actually been a lot of interest in this agreement from red states, from Republican-led states over the years. They haven't been coming close to it in recent years because of how Donald Trump won the White House. But I guarantee you they will be interested in it again if Democrats start picking up some bigger electoral college prizes, places like Texas that Republicans used to count on to get to the White House.
Let me get Steve in on our conversation. I think related to what we were just talking about, this is Steve in Exton calling us on Radio Times. And Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. The question I have has to do with the Electoral College, for your panelists, the Electoral College really an artifact of a constitution that envisioned a government run by the states as opposed to run by the people? And so, like the whole 10th Amendment business where the states get all the powers that aren't in the Constitution, and is the Electoral College simply do we really have to go further and get rid of the whole business of the states themselves?
It's a great question. I appreciate the call to Radio Time. Steve, Kim, do you want to take that?
As indicated before, I mean, I think if you go back in your time machine and think about when the Constitution was ratified, as the caller indicates, people thought of themselves as New Yorkers or Virginians. I mean, there was this sort of deep state loyalty and, of course, the complexity of slavery that was made it for a very different time. And so I think a lot of people believe that it's a relic of the past, although I should say, put a footnote in this, I mean, I think federalism, as a constitutional scholar, federalism, that is the importance of balancing the power of the government between the federal government and the states, I think has sort of come roaring back during this era of COVID, in that we've seen how state governors have taken steps to protect the public in ways that perhaps the federal government didn't. So I think that balance is absolutely crucial, but people understand in their gut that you know, having presidents, now five presidents in office, in notwithstanding a popular vote that chose a different person, doesn't feel right. When they, you know, run these kind of experiments with young children, they even understand that. So I do think that the overriding sentiment that the caller indicates, that it really should be power in we the people, not necessarily we the state legislatures, is something that could tip the scales moving forward. We could see under a Biden administration lots of changes. It's an exciting time in terms of seeing potential fixes to a number of longstanding relics or problems in our system of democracy, which really, really is failing, frankly, on a number of fronts.
Jesse, though, why not just get rid of electors and rely strictly on the national popular vote? Whoever wins the most votes becomes the president of the United States. Do we need electors at all?
I mean, no, I would say we don't. I mean, that was, as we said at the beginning, this was a sort of cobbled together mechanism that actually was decided on just in the final days of the convention. They admitted they had slapped it together later and that they didn't really know how it was going to work. But I just want to touch on this point about states. And I think it's a great question from the caller. And just to follow on what Kim said, you know, actually, yes, people did identify a lot with their states in that time. But remember what the Constitution was doing. It was creating a national government, and that national government was supreme over the states. And if there was a fight about that at the beginning, it was definitely resolved by the Civil War and the Reconstruction Amendments, which made absolutely clear once and for all that the national government was supreme. At the convention itself, you had multiple delegates who were on the nationalist side who were questioning openly the value of having states at all. You know, they would say, wait a minute, why should 40,000 people in one state be equal to 10,000 people in another? This is the effect of magic, not reason, they said. And so I really think it's important to remember that this fight over the importance of states in our national system of government has always been under debate. Just the other point I would make about this, and I really think this is key to thinking about how we choose the president, is nobody votes for the president based on the state they live in. Nobody says, oh, well, I live in Michigan, so I'm voting for this person. People vote based on their support for one party or another, right? And that is key because states don't have voices. States are made up of American people who vote for both Democrats and Republicans and third party candidates. And that, I believe, is how the election for the president should be calculated, because the president is the only office in the country where they're supposed to represent all Americans equally without regard to where they live.
And that's Jesse Wegman, again, a member of the New York Times editorial board, author of a book called Let the People Pick the President, A Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Kim Whaley with us as well. She's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. And, of course, a week away from the big date in November, November 3rd, when we begin at least the countdown to figure out who becomes the next president of the United States, which is why we are talking about the Electoral College. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, whyy.org/radiotimes. Tweet us at whyyradiotimes and call us 1-888-477-9499. Here's a question from Rick, and Kim, I'll put this to you. How are the 270 members elected, and what is their term of office? We're talking about the electors, of course.
You know, that's a really a great question, in that it's not something that is that easy to access. That is basically the parties decide who those people are. It's not done through the same process across the country. And but I think what's important to note is the Supreme Court, in a decision last year, held that those electors are essentially just puppets of the legislature. Essentially, they are not in a position to independently act with discretion, exercise their own discretion to cast their ballots in a manner that's inconsistent with how the states tell them to cast their ballot. So if the state would imposes a penalty, for example, for going off script and voting for some other candidate, that the court held is constitutional. So it's important to keep in mind, I mean, back to the other point, which I get a lot when people ask me the question, what do we say to people who don't want to vote, who think it's a waste of their time to vote if they're in a solidly blue or a solidly red state? There are a lot of reasons to vote, but one of them is the down ballot reason, which is the way to change a lot of these entrenched problems, from gerrymandering to electoral college voting, et cetera, is at the state and even perhaps in some instances the local level. You need to know what's happening at your state level, because that is how some of these elections are resolved. We saw just yesterday, this week, the Supreme Court of the United States basically strike down a decision in Wisconsin by a lower federal court judge that would have allowed ballots to be counted after Election Day if they're postmarked by the 3rd, on the basis that we're in the midst of a pandemic. And a conservative majority said, no, it's the state legislatures, not federal judges, who get to decide that. So that's really where I think the focus needs to be. We're not going to anytime soon convert to a country that's not a collection of individual sovereign states.
And just to pick up on that, there's a Pennsylvania case making its way to the U.S. Supreme Court related to that very particular issue. Jesse Wegman, about these quote-unquote faithless electors, I just want to make sure our listeners and, frankly, that I understand. So are they representing the legislature, or are they representing the people who cast their ballot for president?
You mean electors generally or faithless electors specifically?
Electors generally, but this whole notion of faithless electors that the Supreme Court made a ruling on earlier this year.
Right. So permit me just to recount the history briefly about this, so we can put it in some context. Remember, the framers' idea here was that the electors would be this body of deliberative, well-educated, thoughtful men. And of course, they were only men at that time. Who would choose the fittest leader of the country in state by state. And what happened within the first 10 years of the country's birth completely blew that plan out of the water. And that was the rise of national political parties. They did not design a constitution contemplating the existence of political parties. And as soon as those parties developed, You had a system in which electors stopped being the deliberative, thoughtful men that the founders thought they would be, and instead were just team players, right? They were either Federalists or they were Democratic Republicans, or, you know, they didn't care anymore about picking the fittest leader. They cared about picking their man, right? Whether it was John Adams or Thomas Jefferson. Today, we still have the same system in place. And I think this is something that people still don't understand about when we talk about faithless electors, about how electors work. There isn't a single body of electors in each state just sort of waiting for the people to vote. You know, this is in Pennsylvania, you have 20 electoral votes, right?
That's right.
You don't have 20 people who are electors. Joe Biden has 20 Democratic electors who have pledged to vote for him because they want to vote for him. As Kim said, they're just people who are picked. They're just regular citizens like you and me who happen to know a party leader somewhere in their local community who said, hey, you want to be an elector for the president? Sure, I'll be happy to. Donald Trump also has 20 electors. Whichever candidate wins the most popular votes in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania is a winner-take-all state, like almost all the others, whichever candidate wins the most popular votes gets to send his slate of 20 electors to the state capitol in December to cast their ballots for the president. The reason that faithless electors, that idea, for people who don't understand it, is these are people who end up voting by their choice for someone other than the candidate of their party. It does happen. It's happened a few times in U.S. history. It happened 7 times in 2016, which I think got everybody sort of startled about it, and it's what led to the Supreme Court ruling earlier this year. But what the Supreme Court said was states can basically, if an elector tries to do that, says, you know what, I'm not going to vote for my candidate, I'm going to vote for somebody else because my conscience tells me to. The Supreme Court said states are fully within their constitutional authority to either punish those people or replace them with voters, electors who will vote the right way. And I think that really gets to the heart of it, which is electors on the whole have never been those sort of deliberative people the founders imagined. They have been partisan actors, and they always will be partisan actors. So I don't think this whole issue of faithless electors is going to make a big difference in the outcome of any election.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Jesse Wegman and Kim Whaley. We are talking about the Electoral College, why it exists, and some ideas for reforming it. And we've got much more to talk about after this very short break, including a clip from Trevor Noah about the Electoral College. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the Electoral College with Jesse Wegman. He's got a new book, Let the People Pick the President, A Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. Also, Kim Whaley is with us as well, and her book is What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Let me play a clip, and this goes back almost 4 years, December 7th, 2016. This is Trevor Noah on The Daily Show explaining the electoral system and how Donald Trump won the presidency. Let's give it a listen.
If you're like me, you probably thought that on election day, Americans were going to the polls to elect a president. But if you did vote, your vote didn't go to Clinton or Trump or the best third-party candidate out there, Harambe. When people voted, they were actually voting for electors, who are basically a bunch of locally appointed representatives who then vote on your behalf, which, again, makes no sense to me. Do you understand how weird that is? That's like going to a deli, but for some reason, you can't order for yourself. You're just there at the counter like, hey, can I have a sandwich? And then there's some guy who's like, whoa, 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 I got this. Hey, can he have a sandwich? It's a bizarre twist on an already bizarre system, because there are two ways to pick a president. There's giving it to the person with the most votes, commonly known as democracy. And then there's how America does it.
Kim, is he onto something there, the sandwich metaphor?
Well, sure. You know, what's really interesting, again, as we keep going back to this idea that it's the state legislatures that decide how to tell that guy in the deli to vote for you. I mean, it is sort of this weird process. And the fact that so many people don't even understand it makes sense, right? Because it's obtuse and unclear. And I think we need to have clear rules and clear guidelines for how our electoral process works and what happens when we go to the ballot box. And of course, there are big issues across the country that we have so many different standards. Congress needs to step in and do, you know, fix some of these things. I also think we need more widespread civic literacy. So few people really even understand how government works. Only a third of Americans can name the three branches of government. Wow. But just on that point, the Congress actually has a statute, and this came up in Bush versus Gore, that says that, you know, if it's unclear which slate of ballots to actually vote by December 8th of this year, in this round, the state legislatures can change the law so long as it's done by December 8th. I mean, that's how kind of flippant, frankly, our process works, and how, as we've been saying all along, we need to figure out ways to put the power back in the people, to motivate them to go to the polls and actually have everyone's vote count more.
Well, just picking up on that, and obviously we don't know what's going to happen after November 3rd next week, but if the election ends up in the courts or at the Supreme Court and there are, you know, are suits and countersuits and challenges, and December 8th or December 14th rolls around, what happens to the Electoral College? Do we know?
It's going to be a real mess. You know, the permutations of the situation are so many that I'm not even going to try to walk through them all. But the bottom line is, we really want to avoid a situation where this election ends up in the courts, either in one state or in multiple states. You know, I think this really gets back to just the complexity and confusion that is generated by the system that we currently have. And permit me just to make a little bit of a shift in the framing here,
sure.
Because I think I often see this happen in these debates over, should we have a popular vote or should we have an electoral college? And people argue about the merits of the one and the demerits of the other. And I think I really want to think about it differently. I want to say right now we have a national popular vote for president. The American people go to the polls and they choose either the Democrat or the Republican, or in some cases third parties. But the people vote everywhere. And the reason that that vote is not counted as such, as a popular vote, is purely those state-based winner-take-all laws, which erase tens of millions of voters across the country. In California, 4.5 million people in 2016 voted for Donald Trump. 4.5 million people is more than most states, right? And yet they were completely erased by the winner-take-all law in California. Same thing happened to Democrats in Texas, and you repeat this all over the country, and suddenly your national popular vote becomes this weird amalgam of 100-0 counts in states that don't at all represent what the actual vote is. So I think when people are arguing over this, we should just remember there is a popular vote right now, and it is basically it is basically covered over and then distorted by these winner-take-all laws.
Let me get a couple of callers in on the conversation. We've got Robin in Philadelphia. And Robin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes.
Hi, Robin. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, okay. Hi.
Hi. Oh, you got to turn your radio down.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi. I have a two-part question. One is, I've always been wondering, first of all, which is the election where the candidate got the most popular votes and still lost? And also, like, what is the biggest difference that could actually occur where it would be possible for a candidate to have a tremendous popular vote and still lose the election? And then finally, at what point, if that were the case, would there be some kind of revolt, because we would see that the popular vote was so much greater than the electoral win?
Robin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Kim, it requires a certain amount of math. I'm thinking of 2016. Hillary Clinton got, what, 2 points, more than 2 million more votes than Donald Trump, correct?
Yeah, I don't have those figures at my fingertips, but I think what's important, and perhaps Jesse does, but what's important is this notion of the margin, the delta in the swing states. That's really what could potentially move us into a position where you have a contested election, lots of lawsuits, things dragging on, massive chaos and anxiety. If there are huge margins in favor of one candidate or the other, those are the circumstances where we have a popular vote that essentially lines up with the electoral vote. It's when in certain states the margins are very slim. I mean, George Bush was put in office essentially by the Supreme Court ultimately by 538 or 537 votes in a single state of Florida. That's the point where things get tricky. And I want to make a point about just our common sense around this, and that's come up several times during this conversation, which is, you know, if you've got a kid who's in a little league team, right, and you put him in the game, but you find out along the way that the rules have changed or the rules are really slated in favor of the other team every time, or you just don't really know how it'll turn out, but you just know the rules are going to disfavor your kid. You pull them out of the, probably pull them out of the game and stop, and people stop going. I mean, it's the legitimacy of the system that's at stake, this belief in the integrity of the system being fair that keeps people adhering to democracy itself. And, you know, our adversaries like Vladimir Putin understand this. It's degrading and undermining the system that gets people cynical about the system. And then we lose the entire enterprise of democracy. And that is why it really is not a red versus blue, you know, who wins and who loses enterprise at this point. It's really about protecting the integrity of the system, and the electoral process is front and center of that because people just think it's so unfair.
Jesse, do you think, just briefly, if you don't mind, do you think the Electoral College depresses the vote, that people don't vote because of the Electoral College? Or, I mean, the way we've been talking, it sounds like for many Americans, they don't really understand how it works.
Absolutely, it does. I mean, we have evidence of that in swing states. Every 4 years, the turnout is significantly higher than in non-swing states. And I think that's just evidence that people know when their vote matters, they're more likely to vote.
Yeah. Let me get, looks like Vicki calling us from Reading, Pennsylvania. And Vicki, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi, Vicki. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to explain why I support the Electoral College, and then I have a question.
Sure.
So I remember seeing a map after George Bush won, and it showed the blue, you know, the Democratic votes, and those just were concentrated around large cities and some on the coast. And then the vast, vast majority of the map was red, you know, with Republican votes. And I do think that different geographic areas do have different interests. So my question is, if there was not an Electoral College, why would candidates bother to campaign in the interior of the country when they could just get all the votes they needed around the large cities and the coast?
That's a fair question, Vicki. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jesse, let me toss that to you.
Sure. I mean, that's one of the most common defenses of the Electoral College. And, you know, I appreciate the caller articulating it so well, because it is a fair question about how do I ensure that my elected representatives care about me? And the answer is, it's actually the way the system works right now. Both candidates, as well as the president, completely ignore the vast majority of the country. And that includes those dark blue, you know, coastal areas, and it includes the dark red heartland. You know, I know that it looks like when you look at that map that huge swaths of America are red, but in fact, most of that is just empty land. Doesn't mean that there are millions of more Republicans there. It just means that those states are big and not particularly populated. They're geographically big and not particularly populated. And so I think this gets us back to that problem of, it's the battleground states. Those are the only states that the candidates care about, and they're the only states that really presidents care about. You know, watch how Donald Trump talks about, you know, states that are sort of safe states, right? He openly mocks them, Democrat cities. And, you know, who cares about California, because they're not going to ever vote for me. He lets, you know, people in New York die of COVID by the thousands because New York's never going to give him their electoral votes. That's the essential violation of basic representative democracy principles that I think is the system we live under. So right now, candidates don't care about the vast majority of the country. Mm-hmm. They don't go to Wyoming. They don't go to Idaho. They don't go to Washington. They don't go to Rhode Island. They don't go anywhere except Florida, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, you know, maybe five or six states in a given year. And I think, you know, if you are concerned about candidates caring about what you care about, caring about the issues that matter to you, and if you're concerned about presidents governing in a way that actually treats you as equal to everyone else in America, you want a popular vote election because that would force the candidates and the president to behave in that way.
Let me get another caller to join our conversation. And this is Fred in Springfield. And Fred, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi. I was just wondering if any consideration. Hello.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I was wondering if there's any consideration being given to the Electoral College spreading out their votes relative to the percentage of the vote won by a candidate in the state. In other words, if like in Pennsylvania, if you win 52% of the vote, you would get 10.4 Electoral College votes.
Let me put that to you, Kim. And I believe there are two states, Maine and Nebraska, that do proportional, Electoral College representation. I'm hoping I'm saying that correctly. Kim, you want to speak to that?
My understanding is a little more complicated than just straight up, you know, splitting it. But I don't know in this moment, with the exception of what Jesse mentioned in terms of the sort of interstate compact, to agree to basically the states would agree under their laws that if the popular vote nationally were going one way, they would basically ignore what the requirements they had on the books for which slate of electors to vote and go with a popular vote. I don't know what's happening in any particular state, but just to the last caller's point as mm-hmm. to whether going with more of a popular vote would somehow move presidential candidates to, you know, the border states, the more highly populated states. There are experts that have made that argument, that have essentially argued that a proportional vote system would create problems. So I do think, you know, I don't have the exact answer on how best to do it, whether Nebraska or Maine can have it down or not. The point is that it's broken. The point is it's not working now. And so some brain trust needs to be put into, and some political capital needs to be put into figuring out a better system. It's not a black or white proposition, which is unfortunately how we often talk about these complex constitutional and political issues and even policy-based issues, as if it's all one bucket or all another bucket. This one is too complicated for that. But one thing is for sure, the current system is not acceptable for many, many Americans.
Jesse, we're almost
Marty,
out of
could
time.
I weigh in here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Just to respond. So what's happening in Maine and Nebraska is not a proportional awarding of the votes. They do it by congressional district.
Okay.
And that is actually a system that has been used since the founding by many states. Just today, Maine and Nebraska are the only states that happen to do it. They give one elector to the candidate who wins a congressional district, and then they give their two Senate-based electors to the winner of the statewide vote. So Barack Obama took an electoral vote from Nebraska in 2008. You know, Donald Trump took one from Maine in 2016. What the caller is suggesting, which is a fractional system where you could get 10.4, right? It's a really interesting system, and it actually would get us closer to a popular vote than any other system out there. The problem is electors are human beings, and they cannot be divided into fractions. So in order to have that fractional system that the caller articulated, you would need a constitutional amendment. And then we're back to the problem Kim identified, you know, earlier in the hour, which is a constitutional amendment is very hard to pass.
Well, and we're almost out of time. And Jesse, if you don't mind, I'm going to just toss this back to you. But does the Electoral College, is part of the problem of the Electoral College is that it sees us as either red states or blue states? Is that a problem?
That's exactly it. I mean, the red state, blue state phenomenon is really just a visual artifact of the winner-take-all law. You know, we call a state blue, it makes it sound as though there are no Republicans there, or a red state where there's no Democrats, but everyone lives everywhere, right? We are
sure.
A purple country from coast to coast. We're not red and blue. Everyone lives everywhere, and everyone supports people based on which party they adhere to, not where they live. So I just think that is that image is really distorting and really needs to be done away with through a popular vote.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times to talk about the Electoral College. Jesse Wegman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. He's a member of the New York Times editorial board, author of Let the People Pick the President. Kim Whaley, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having me. It was a great chat.
Thanks so much. And she's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. Her book is What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast, which you can do wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us.